Next case is 10-988, Robin White versus Warren Limbach. Mr. Galvin.
Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Martin Galvin on behalf of appellant Dr. Warren Limbach. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttable time, if that's possible. Your Honors, this case presents a legal question which previously had been answered consistently by every appellate court in Ohio to which it was presented.
Counsel, this opinion doesn't really set any rule of law, does it? Because we have one judge with one opinion, one judge concurring in result only, and one judge dissenting. This opinion doesn't really create any rule of law, does it?
Justice Kupp, I would agree that the authority that would be generated by the decision below would be persuasive in nature, not binding authority. And even if it was a unanimous panel, there's still contrary decisions from all across the state, and there's still contrary decisions within the 10th district.
That brings me to my question is, you both cite the Hillman versus Kosnick case, which we sent back, well, we basically improvidently allowed it, and we put in a do not cite, and yet both of you cite it. So that's a problem right there, that you cited it when it said do not cite. And secondly, since there was apparently a conflict, I looked at both cases. Why didn't anyone seek an en banc?
Your Honor, the way that the plurality opinion was written was that it suggested that there was no conflict, that there was no bright line rule, and this was sort of a flexible rule of practice that courts had been adopting. So rather than seeking en banc, we sought jurisdiction to this court.
Because the opinion written in this case seems to clearly say that you don't have to have expert testimony, but the Hillman case seemed to clearly say you did, so there does seem to be a conflict.
I definitely agree that there's a conflict. I would just suggest that the author of the plurality opinion below suggested that there wasn't a conflict. It was phrased in such a way that he said this rule has never really existed. He said that what these courts are doing is they're looking to Bruni from 1976, and there's just this mere dicta, and everybody's seizing on this mere dicta, and they're making too much of it. And the portions of Bruni that is being used is just a fleeting reference.
Should we send this back for a non-bond consideration? Then your district can decide it once and for all, because you've got contrary law already in the district.
Well, I would suggest that the opinion below suggests that there's really no guidance from this court. The last word from this court was the Nichol versus Gonzalez decision in 1985. And the court did a very good job of outlining the elements of a lack of informed consent claim. What the court didn't do is explicitly say, number one, a lack of informed consent claim is indeed a medical malpractice claim. That's what I suggest the court should do here. And number two, there's no special exemption for lack of informed consent claims from the need of expert testimony.
Give us an idea of what that expert testimony would be like.
Certainly, the appellants had two experts of their own. And they each provided testimony that was clear, it was unambiguous, and it was to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. They said that no known material risk was undisclosed. They said that no...
Did they outline those material risks, those known material risks?
Yes, certainly. Dr. Miner did, specifically in the context of his conversation with Mr. White prior to the second surgery. Each expert also said...
I mean at trial. They talked, they testified as to what the known risks were and the implications and the fact that they delineated what they had to be communicated to the patient.
Yes, Chief Justice, I should have been more clear. Dr. Minor did that. He recounted his conversation with Mr. White during his trial testimony and said these are the things that should have been talked about and these were the things that were actually talked about. And then he also said that no undisclosed material risk ever actually occurred and that there was no proximate causation.
You say Dr. White, that's his testimony.
Well, that's the testimony of both Dr. Ray and Dr. Minor, who both testified in expert capacities at trial.
And their testimony was that the things that Dr. White said he said to the patient are the things that a doctor are required to disclose.
Correct. And they also said that no undisclosed risk actually occurred, which is part of the second element of Nickel. And they also said that there was no proximate causation between any undisclosed material risk and the injury that Mr. White complains of. And Justice Pfeiffer, to further answer your question, I think what an expert should have come in and testified is what should have been told to Mr. White given his actual presentation, given his actual symptoms, given his age, and given his history. We don't have that. All we have is some anecdotal evidence from a dated study from 1989 showing what some results were for a group of patients that Mr. White clinically did not fit into. And there's really no meaningful dispute that Mr. White was not clinically or would not clinically fit into that group of patients from the 1989 study. The case law cited by appellees is Canterbury versus Spence. It was mentioned in a footnote in Bruni, but it's a 1972 D.C. Circuit case. And interestingly, the opinion in Canterbury spoke of the need to unburden plaintiffs from the shackles of expert testimony in medical malpractice litigation. But 4 years later, in 1976, Ohio chose a different option. That's when Bruni versus Tatsumi was released, and Ohio chose to impose a requirement of expert testimony in medical malpractice cases. And the facts of Bruni did actually include a claim for lack of informed consent. That was one of the claims in that case, and this court did not see the need to unburden plaintiffs of their obligation to present expert evidence to support that claim as well as the other claims.
So isn't one of the claims here by the appellee is that informed consent, lack of informed consent cases are not medical malpractice cases, so the language of Bruni doesn't apply to this situation?
Yes, Your Honor, that is one of their contentions.
And you're saying that in order to outline the information that should be part of the informed consent, you're going to need a doctor that's going to, an expert that's going to be able to speak to the technicalities, the medical technicalities of that subject matter.
Correct, Your Honor. They need to speak to the probability of the risk and the magnitude of the risk. And that's straight out of McGlosky versus Kest, an 8th District case. And it's not as if this issue hasn't been decided by appellate courts. The Fernandez opinion, West versus Cleveland Clinic, Badger versus McGregor, and Valerius versus Freeman all talked about the requirement for expert testimony. And as far as the need for expert testimony on the first prong of the Nickel standard, that is, what is the material risk that should have been disclosed but was not disclosed, you have a host of cases that have talked about that, including Kester versus Brakel, Pierce versus Goldman, and Tutt versus Ahmed, and Badger versus McGregor again.
Assuming that we agree with your position that this would be a medical claim, the argument is made by Mr. White's counsel that based on the cross-examination of your client's expert, there is medical testimony here that the most likely cause of the injury was the excision of the scar tissue.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is their position. I would disagree, and I think...
Well, is that some evidence that would be considered?
No.
I mean, they wouldn't have to have their own expert if they have the expert testimony available. Isn't that right?
If they had competent expert testimony on the actual issues that they needed competent expert testimony on. Instead, you have some leading questions on cross-examination, which really don't stand for the proposition that they're being put forth for. And I think Judge French below in his dissent did an excellent job of dissecting exactly why Dr. Ray and Dr. Miner did not say the things that appellees want to say that they said at trial.
So that's disputed, is what you're saying.
It's very much disputed. For example, there was a colloquy back and forth between counsel and Dr. Ray, where Dr. Ray said, no, this isn't as a result of surgery. And he said, well, what is it a result of? And he said, it's a combination of factors. And then after he said it's a combination of factors, counsel asked him a question, well, isn't surgery the most likely cause of these combination of factors? And he did agree, yes, which may or may not have been inconsistent with his earlier testimony.
Do you see that as an element that needs to be proven as a medical claim in an informed consent case?
I do very much, Your Honor. And it's also my position that merely saying that out of a potential dozens of causes of a condition, that this is the most likely, that doesn't speak to a probability as to proximate causation, which I think is the appropriate standard.
But the informed consent is to advise of the risks of the procedure, is it not?
It is, to the risk of the procedure, which are known and which are material. And that's where the expert testimony comes in. We have to use experts to talk about whether these risks are actually known by practitioners in the medical community. And we have to say whether they're material. I mean, is this a one in a million? Is it a one in a thousand? Or is
so
it
what would a rule of law look like if we agreed with your position?
Well, the proposition of law that I cited is not verbatim from Fernandez, but it's very close.
So you're relying heavily on Fernandez?
I'm relying heavily on the Fernandez holding because I think it encapsulated what this court needs to say in order to clarify this issue. And that is, a plaintiff must present expert testimony on all of the elements of a lack of informed consent claim, including what the undisclosed material risk was and whether the undisclosed material risk actually occurred.
Mr. Galvin, we have not yet, this court has not yet said that an informed consent claim, right here, is a medical claim, correct? We have not said that. Because our previous cases seem to suggest that we talk about this as a common law or separate tort anytime that there's a case that is discussing informed consent as a claim, it's listed separate and apart from medical negligence. Would you agree, or have we actually stated that lack of informed consent is a medical claim or a claim for medical negligence?
Justice Lanziger, I'd respectfully suggest that that's been somewhat of a gray area, and that's why we have these references to dicta and to fleeting references. What we have is Bruni in 1976 and Nickel in 1985, and there is some discussion. I would not say, especially in Nickel, that that they're categorized differently and that there's a assumption that they're two different types of claims. I would say that the assumption in Nickel is that it is a medical malpractice claim. But that I would agree that that's not explicitly spelled out, and I would further agree that that's what's led to the confusion that brings us here today.
To rule in your favor, would we have to go so far as to make that clear, that it is, in fact, a medical negligence claim?
I think that would be warranted, that if you were to rule in my favor, that it should be made clear that it is a medical malpractice claim, and that there's no special exemption from the requirements that apply to all other medical malpractice claims, including, you know, the requirements of affidavits of merit, which you see in Civil Rule 10D2, or the requirements for expert testimony as far as the percentage of time that must be devoted to practice, being credentialed, all those things that you see in Evidence Rule 601D.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, Charles Cooper here on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. White. It's a fundamental principle that every person has the right to make decisions with respect to his or her own body. And when it comes to surgery, that right requires that a patient be informed of material risks so that he or she can make a knowledgeable decision. In Ohio, we protect that right through informed consent, by requiring informed consent. And that did not occur here. There is a significant dispute, even in the briefs to this court, as to what the record says. In our brief, we've done our best to actually repeat transcript testimony, Q&A, Q&A, so that the court can see the positions that we're taking. In particular, questions were asked from the bench whether or not material risks were identified and disclosed in this case. The testimony at trial showed that Dr. Limebach and Dr. Miner agreed that with respect to a second surgery at the same location on a person's back, which was referred to throughout the trial as a redo surgery, the second surgery has a substantially greater risk of a failed outcome, a poor outcome. The person is going to be significantly worse off than before the surgery. Dr. Limebach, the defendant, admitted that at trial. Dr. Miner agreed that that was the case. And they both agreed that that significantly increased risk needs to be disclosed to a patient. And it stands to reason. A patient needs to know that information to
decide
whether or not.
I wasn't quite sure about the increased risk of a bad outcome, what that meant. It was an increased risk that the surgery would not relieve the symptoms, or that increased, substantial increased risk that, in fact, it would make the symptoms worse. It seems to be used in kind of a broad brush here, and I wasn't quite sure what was being asserted.
I believe the testimony at trial was the latter, that the substantially increased risk of a poor outcome was that the patient would be worse off than before the surgery, not simply the same, but and not improved, but worse off.
Okay. And counsel, is that risk associated with a redo surgery because of additional deterioration of the vertebrae, or, as in this case, because of an accident that triggered the necessity for a redo? There's, I mean, two different causations as to why you would need an additional surgery.
Fair question, Your Honor. The testimony at trial from Dr. Miner was that the fall that occurred at Cedar Point when Mr. Uh-huh. White slipped in the rain did not cause the additional pain that we see after the second surgery because it was too remote in time.
Isn't there an agreement that the fall, the accident, precipitated the need for the second surgery?
The fall caused Mr. White to go back to Dr. Limebach, because it's true that the fall caused Mr. White to experience pain again, but it was pain similar to the pain he had before the first surgery. So he went back to Dr. Limebach. Dr. Limebach says, it's the same thing. We're going to do the same surgery.
And isn't there expert testimony that that was the appropriate course of action? Dr. Miner said there's no question. That's what he would have done.
Surgery was not inappropriate. What Mr. White wasn't told, and what Dr. Limebach knew, was that when you go in for the second surgery, internal scarring has occurred as a result of the first surgery, and that internal scarring makes the second surgery much more difficult.
And Mr. White never heard any information about scarring?
Not quite. Mrs. White, who attended all the doctor appointments with her husband, had heard from a friend to ask about scarring, which she believed referred to the superficial scar mm-hmm. that forms after surgery on the skin. And she asked Dr. Limebach, according to the testimony, what about scarring? And his response was, I never cut out scarring. It only comes back twice as worse as before. So Dr. Limebach indicated, and I believe there were two ships passing in the night, maybe he was talking about internal scarring, not realizing she was talking about the superficial scar. But there was no discussion about that scarring was going to increase the likelihood of a poor outcome, the second surgery. And Dr. Limebach—
Was there an option?
There would have been an option, because the testimony showed, and Dr. Limebach's own notes showed, and he admitted at trial, that Mr. White had informed him that heat and Percocet were relieving the pain. So Mr. White could have gotten by simply with continued heat and Percocet and relieved the pain. And certainly, had he known that the risk of a second surgery was substantially greater, that he would be worse off, a reasonable person would have continued down that path.
Mr. Cooper, is the lack of informed consent a separate tort, or is it a medical claim in your view?
It arises out of the tort of battery, because in essence it's an unauthorized touching. If I'm not given sufficient information so that I can make a knowledgeable decision, I haven't given you permission to perform the medical procedure. by you going forward and doing it, it's a battery. So it did arise out of the common law notion of battery.
But the cases cited by the appellate opinion, or actually only one case, really is not an informed consent case. It's a case where the person underwent treatment that they didn't know that they never even authorized. Here, your client clearly authorized the surgery, so those cases don't support it. And other than that one case, can you cite any other case in all of our history where we have found the informed consent tort to be a battery claim?
I cannot, and I agree with you that the in some instances where a surgeon has, for example, amputated the wrong leg, I mean, clearly you have a battery and an authorized.
And those that seems to be the only cases that even support Judge Tyak's opinion is not even the same. It doesn't even involve informed consent.
Those cases are different, but the notion I suggest is the same, that if a patient hasn't given permission because they haven't received sufficient information to give the permission, then it's an unauthorized touching. In this case, I don't believe that it would make a difference whether it's referred to as a medical claim, medical negligence, or a...
Although we have cases that say medical claims must be supported by expert testimony. And if you talk about it being a separate tort, as some of the cases that are cited suggest, they say medical claims, and then they say, lack of informed consent, the argument, I think, isn't your argument stronger that you wouldn't need necessarily expert testimony if you're talking about a separate tort?
Yes, it is, Justice Lanziger, but in part because of the nature of the evidence that underlies it, not necessarily because of the label that's attached to the claim. Expert testimony, of course, is required if the information is beyond the knowledge of a layperson. In many medical negligence cases, that's going to be true because you're going to have expert testimony about the standard of care, for example. Standard of care does not come into play.
And how in this case could a layperson testify about the risks associated with a complex thing like back surgery, especially one that's the second surgery?
We agree that in most instances, medical testimony would be required to inform the jury as to what the significant risks were.
And you had no medical testimony. Well, in fact, the study that you relied on really involved a failed first surgery, not a re-injury, which was involved here.
We did have testimony. We had an admission by the defendant himself.
That's what you're claiming. You didn't have your own testimony. You're claiming their testimony put you into that category.
That's correct. And because the directed verdict was sought at the close of all of the evidence, the plaintiff gets the benefit of the expert testimony of the defense as well.
So you're saying that Dr. Lineback was an expert, a substitute for expert testimony?
Well, Dr. Lineback was a board-certified surgeon.
But he wasn't a practitioner when he testified. He didn't meet the test for an expert medical witness.
No, but he was a defendant who made these admissions at trial.
Well, you're equating then the defendant's admissions and cloaking them with the expert testimony status.
Well,
you want that to substitute for you putting forth an expert witness?
In some instances, I believe that is appropriate, Your Honor. In this instance, we had not only Dr. Lineback's testimony, but we had Dr. Miner's testimony as well, that there was a significant increase in the risks associated with a redo surgery and that those must be disclosed to the patient. So Dr. Miner also testified as to that effect. But it is appropriate, I believe, that in instances where the defendant is a board-certified surgeon and makes admissions, whether it's through an answer to the complaint or a request for admissions or his trial testimony, that the jury should be permitted to take that admission into account in deciding whether or not to rule for the plaintiff.
What about evidence of a proximate cause relationship here between an undisclosed risk and what actually occurred? Was there any evidence, expert evidence offered on that point?
Yes, I'll give you the quick answer, which is yes, and then if I may explain. This case is a little different than a lot of informed consent cases. In many informed consent cases, a risk such as infection or bleeding may not have been disclosed. And then we look to see whether or not that risk materialized in the procedure and caused harm. We have something different here. The risk that was not disclosed was the substantial increase and the potential for harm.
But isn't that rather amorphous? I mean, if you talk about bleeding, we're talking about something specific. Infection is something specific. And if you're, as the response to Justice Kupp was, if we're talking about just increase in bad outcome, I mean, what is specific about that?
Well, if a jury concludes that it is significant enough that a reasonable person in the plaintiff's condition would not have proceeded with the therapy or medical procedure or surgery, then in a situation where the material risk was the increase in a substantial increase in the risk of a poor outcome, causation should be established by virtue of the fact that the plaintiff was not told about it and proceeded with the surgery and came out worse than before.
Your real concern is that this should have been put before the jury.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Can I follow up, because you alluded to Dr. Miner. I don't believe, was Dr. Miner an expert? I believed he was not qualified as an expert on that specific issue, was he? On the issue of informed consent. Was he qualified as an expert to testify on that?
As my recollection, and Dr. Miner's testimony was played by videotape, recorded in advance, but my recollection was that he was qualified openly as an expert.
I thought I read he had given some caveats in terms of testifying on that specific issue, but I could be wrong. I guess my concern is, how would you propose that we limit this? Because you said not all cases would require expert testimony, and I'm trying to figure out the strategy for not bringing in an expert, and we have an amicus brief that suggests that if we accept your proposition that this would open the floodgates and these cases would all be treated as fact-based rather than what is really an appropriate, reasonable standard of care.
Well, we are in agreement with the appellant that medical testimony is appropriate to identify the nature of the risk, what the significant risks are. We're in agreement with that. And that was in the record. The testimony identifying the risk is in the record. We don't believe, though, that expert testimony is required on every element of an informed consent claim as the proposition of law requires. And in fact, in Nickel, it's clear that expert testimony is not required on every element of an informed consent claim. Because part of the, one of the elements of in the Nickel test is left to the jury to decide. What would a reasonable person under the similar circumstances have done had they been informed of these material risks?
Is that why you didn't have an expert at trial? Is that you?
There are two reasons. One, we did have the defendant Linebach's testimony and his own office notes where immediately after the surgery, he says, this is what I was afraid of. We just made it worse. And we believe that's an admission back at the time right after the surgery that he's acknowledging the causation between what he didn't disclose and what happened.
That could go to a known risk that, I mean, that doesn't tell us that that's a causation issue. That just tells you it's an outcome, but it doesn't tell you anything beyond that.
We believe that should have been something for the jury to decide. Taking Dr. Linebach's words straight up, we believe, you know, when he says that we just made it worse, but that's something that the jury should have been able to
decide.
Well,
what's your second reason for not?
The second reason, Your Honor, is more of a practical one for those of us that typically handle plaintiff's cases, and that is that in this day and age, it has become increasingly difficult to find experts willing to testify in surgery cases against other doctors when their professional organizations blackball them if they testify against another physician. It has become.
So you're saying you didn't have one?
We did not have one in this case.
Mr. Cooper, what is your response to the questions asked earlier of Mr. Galvin regarding the en banc consideration by the 10th District? And do you see this as an internal conflict in the 10th District?
My review of the cases within the 10th District isn't such that this shapes up as a sharp conflict.
It what? Between, it,
my review of the cases of the 10th District is such that it doesn't appear to me to be a sharp conflict. The cases, such as Bruni, for example, are distinguishable on their facts. And I believe in some cases expert testimony may be required, in others it may not be.
Okay.
I see that my time is
Thank
up.
You.
Thank you.
Mr. Galvin, you've reserved a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to point out a couple of facts for the court as far as why, when you don't have expert testimony, you get shaky medicine. What we have here is there's hints that there was an MRI performed and that it was read wrong. Maybe there was a misdiagnosis, but that's not actually supported in the record, but that's still that the hint of that happened, which is really a medical negligence case, is contained throughout the record. There's also insinuations that maybe there was some scar tissue damage done. That's not supported in the record.
Well, counsel, isn't Mr. Cooper right that if you have an admission by the doctor, that trumps expert testimony? I mean, if you have an admission of the defendant against interest, then you don't need to be talking about experts of any kind, do you?
Well, Justice, I would disagree that there's any admission. Certainly, if he got on the stand and said, you know, I failed to tell him of a known risk and it happened and it caused him injury, that would be an admission. What Dr. Lineback actually said is that he was disappointed that he encountered scar tissue and he's afraid that he made it worse. We all agree that the scar tissue was discussed. It's not reasonable to think that Dr. Lineback was talking about a little scar on his back. He was talking about scar tissue encountered during the surgery. If the Whites misunderstood that, it's unfortunate, but I don't think it changes the fact that was discussed. And the mere candid recognition in a note that happened doesn't create issues of fact on lack of informed consent claims. There's also all
Thank
kinds
you.
Of,